Job chapter 1 is where we're going to be starting. We're going to be going back and forth between a couple of texts, but the first one is in Job chapter 1. So if you're using your Pew Bible, that's page 389. And I invite you to turn there and read some verses with me. Do you ever experience moments in your life where it doesn't seem like you're having as much of an influence as you would like to have, or that your life isn't being noticed as much as you wish that it would be, or that the work that you're doing is not as far-reaching or productive as you'd like it to be? I think all of us can relate to feelings like that, no matter what industry you're a part of, no matter what kind of lifestyle you're living, no matter whether you are married or you're single or what your personal situation is. I think all of us sometimes have feelings of, does my life really matter that much? And what we need to be thoughtful about when we have those feelings are passages like Job chapter 1, as well as Ephesians. We're going to look at Ephesians 6 and Ephesians 4, the book that Matthew just took us to. And we need to be thoughtful about how our lives have much more consequence than sometimes we realize. That our lives are not just exhibits for the other people around us in this world or the other people around us in our congregation. That spiritual creatures are looking at us. And that they're looking hard at us. They're not just taking a passing glance as they fly through the heavens doing whatever they do up there. That, oh yeah, there are these little people down there. Aren't we so thankful that we're angels and not them? They stare at our lives. We are exhibits for the spiritual creatures in the heavenly places, not just lights in this world to other people. We need to be thoughtful about how much our lives matter, even when we can't see with our eyes the effects of our lives. We need to look at these passages and realize just what our struggle is about, the warfare that we are waging, and think about what is going on in these texts. So go with me to Job chapter 1. We're going to start reading here in verse 6. If you glance over Job chapter 1, you notice the opening five verses are about Job's character, where he talks about how he is a blameless and upright man. He fears God. He turns away from evil. And then there is this description of the blessings that he has. He is loaded up with animals. He's loaded up with children. You think six children is a lot. Well, Job had 10. But try that on. All right, and notice what happens with his blessings and with his character. He continually offers sacrifices in the morning after his kids feast and get together, because it says at the end of verse 5, he says, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." That is a description of how he fears God, of how he is blameless and upright. He is not just concerned about his own character and his own lifestyle. He's also continually going to God for the lives of other people, those closest to him. That is seen as a good thing in this text. Now notice in verse 6, the scene shifts very dramatically to a scene that Job could not see or understand or be a part of. But as the readers of this book, we get the curtain peeled back for us to see the inner workings of heaven at this particular junction of time. Notice what it says, verse 6. "There came a day..." Now, exactly how that can be defined in the heavenly places, I'm not sure. But using our language, "There came a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, 'From where have you come?' Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil.' Then Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You bless the work of his hands. and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hands and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. All right, so we need to think seriously about this rather strange and interesting passage. I want you to notice something about Satan here. Notice that his focus and his energy is entirely directed at planet Earth and the people that are on it. I think the question that God asked is very interesting. He says, before you came into the throne room with all the other angels and the sons of God, and I'm not sure exactly what this gathering was all about, but it's a big to-do in heaven, and they're all there, and Satan is there too. It's interesting. You know? And he's just waltzing in, and God says, hey, where you been? And it's interesting what Satan says about that. Satan could have said, well, you know, the Andromeda Galaxy is really beautiful this time of year, so I was over there, or I was, you know, in a black hole, or I was tracking a shooting star over in this galaxy, or I was in the heavenly places, and I was going where, you know, angels go, you know, somewhere else. But he was in this physical realm, and not just anywhere in this physical realm. He's on planet Earth. And he wasn't just there for a second. You know, he said, I've been walking around on it. I've been going to and fro on planet Earth. Of all the places that he could have been, isn't it scary that he's here? And evidently, that is not just something that he does very, very occasionally, because in chapter 2 in Job, there is the same kind of scene, and the sons of God come to present themselves before the Lord again. And in verse 2 of chapter 2, God asks Satan the exact same question, and Satan gives the exact same response. So you get the sense that this is just his normal behavior, that this is his stomping ground. This is where he sets up shop. You know, he's not here for the scenery. He's not here for Hawaii or China, you know, just beautiful things around this planet that we might travel to go see. He's here for the people. He's here because this is his dominion that he has tried to set up to usurp the place of God in this beautiful creation that he has made. He wants to be the king of this planet, not God. And so this is a scary situation, but we need to recognize how much his focus and energy is on us, because this is where we are, and his goal and desire is to eat us alive. When you go to Jude, verse 9, it's really interesting that there's a description of an argument that's taking place between the devil and Michael the archangel, and they're arguing about the physical body of Moses. And we're not told exactly what that argument was all about, we can speculate, but the very fact that he's having an argument in the heavenly places about some dead guy here is something that should raise our eyebrows. This is what he is focused on. This is what's consuming him. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around here like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. You know, in the Gospel of John, Jesus says, my food is to do the will of my Father who is in heaven. What is the devil's food? It's us. He is going around here as much and as often as he can, trying to find people to walk into his open jaws. So that's a rather scary thing that his energy is focused on us here. And so because of that, you notice he follows Job's life and Job's allegiance very closely. I think it's kind of ironic that there are scientists who are working very hard in universities and in industries to point telescopes up at the sky to try to see what is beyond this planet. And yet there are angels like the devil who are so focused on looking at us in our lives on this planet here. And notice what happens here. When God says, In chapter 1, verse 8, have you considered my servant Job? And the very fact that God himself would bring up the name of a human to this host of heavenly creatures is rather mind-blowing in and of itself. That the angels and God have discussions about us is rather mind-blowing, isn't it? And so one man is brought up in particular. Have you considered my servant Job? You remember what Peter says? This is a little bit of a sidetrack. But you remember in 1 Peter 1, how Peter says that when it comes to the gospel and its effect on people, angels long to look into these things. Well, here's a conversation that's very much like that. And so have you considered my servant Job? Have you thought about him? Do you know about his life? And Satan doesn't say, well, let's see, Job. You know, that sort of rings a bell. Maybe I've heard of him. Satan knows everything about Job that he can possibly know. And he doesn't know everything that God knows. He's not omniscient. He's not omnipresent. He can't be everywhere. He can't understand everything that God does. But to whatever extent he is able to understand Job, he has read the file. He's looked him up. He knows what he can know. And because you notice what he says about Job. He says, yeah, I know about him because I know that there's a hedge in between me and him that you have put up. And I understand all the blessings that you have dumped into his lap. And I understand that there is a spiritual force field that is keeping me from going at him. But if you would just let out my leash, if you would just remove that hedge, you know, I can show you a few things about who he really is. You say that he's blameless and upright. Yeah, okay, that's your opinion. But if you take away those things that he has, he's going to curse you to your face. And we'll get into that in just a second. It is comforting to me, passages like Hebrews 4:13, where God says about himself, there is no creature hidden from his sight, but we are all naked and exposed to the eyes of him, of God, to whom we must give account. Satan does not have that kind of power over us. Thank God for that. And sometimes when we talk about Satan, it might be tempting to think that he is on an equal playing field with God, that you have the forces of evil and the forces of good, and they are equally matched. They are not equally matched. Satan cannot hold a candle to the power that Jesus and the Father and the Spirit wields. I mean, he is the true ruler of the heavens and the earth, and all Satan can do is nip at his heels as hard as he can. But he is someone that we are fighting against who should be feared because he's developed his own bag of tricks that he has used with great success with everyone's lives. And that's why we've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. But on some level, he is aware of who we are. He's aware of how to tempt us, as with Job. And so what he does in this conversation with God is he maliciously declares that God's faith, that Job's faith rests on Job's comfortable life that God has given. And you know, Satan has always, ever since the garden in the beginning of Genesis 3, he's always tried to distort the truth about who God is and what God wants to do with us, his humans that he's put on this planet. He does that here. And so in the beginning, he told Eve, God is holding back goodness from you. You know, he's keeping something that would be great for you to have. And in here, he's almost making the opposite kind of accusation. That God, you have dumped goodness on this person. And so of course he likes you. Of course he serves you. But if you took some of that away, then you would really see his true colors. But, of course, what happens to Job? Even though Satan says in verse 11, stretch out your hand, touch all that he has, and he will curse you to his face. If you go to the end of this chapter, after Job has lost all of his children and all of his stuff, he's about to lose his health in chapter 2. But at the end of chapter 1, notice what it says. Verse 22, in all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. And then despite what his wife says in chapter 2, verse 9, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. The very thing that Satan said that he would do, he doesn't do it. You notice that? He says, shall we receive good from God and not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So he resists that temptation. And if you read the rest of the book of Job, you can see places in the poetry where he kind of crosses the line in some areas and he becomes really bitter and antagonistic against God because he doesn't even know about the existence of the devil. And that's really clear. He thinks that, if you read the rest of the book, that the conflict is just between him and God. And he cries out for a rescuer and a redeemer and a judge to adjudicate between the two. He doesn't even have an awareness of Satan at this point in time. And God, as far as we know, doesn't tell him about Satan. But in chapter 13, in verse 15, he says this, though he slay me, it's chapter 13 in verse 15, though he slay me, talking about God, I will hope in him, yet I will argue my ways to his face. And he gets a chance to do that at the end of the book, and God just says, okay, look, where were you when I made everything? Can you take care of the animals like I do? Do you have an understanding like I have? And Job says, I cover my face, I cover my mouth, and you are God, and I'll trust you with that. That's how the book ends. So Satan is wrong sometimes about his assessments about people, but this is who we are fighting. And when you go to the book of Ephesians, this point is brought to the forefront of that letter. Go now to Ephesians and go to the passage that Matthew read for us. He did a fine job reading, but I'm going to go ahead and read it again now that we've got the background of Job in our minds. Go to Ephesians chapter 6. As Paul is wrapping up this letter, he has spent a lot of time talking about how to walk in unity and love and what that looks like in the Christian's life and what it looks like in relationships between husbands and wives and children and parents and slaves and masters. Then verse 10, he starts to wrap it up and says, finally, be strong in the Lord. No matter who you are, what gender you are, what relationship you have, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against who? Against the schemes of Satan. This one that we've just been looking at, the devil. And then he goes on to elaborate. And he says, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand firm. So Job's fight was not primarily against the three friends who came to him as he sat in the ashes and attempted to comfort him, but actually just antagonized him. You know, they were certainly hurtful and sinful. They said foolish things. And God says at the end of that book, you guys have done wrong. You need to repent. But Job's primary fight was against the forces of darkness. And Job is not the only book where that scene kind of happens and when this point is brought to the forefront. If you go to the book of Daniel, in fact, we're not going to turn there, but on your own time, go back and read Daniel 10 sometime. Daniel, as an old, old man serving the king of Persia, he is praying about the future and about his people because they're still living in exile at that point in time. And he gets an angel that shows up in his room that just knocks him off of his feet. And the angel picks him up and says, you know, I've been trying to get to you for 21 days now. But I've been in a battle with the prince of Persia, another angel, and I got stuck fighting him for a long time. And so I've been trying to reach you because we heard your prayers up there and God sent me to you.
but Michael the archangel had to come help me out with my battle with this other angel, and so I'm here now to tell you about what's going to happen to your people, but after I leave, I'm going to have to go back and fight that angel again. You know, we don't know a lot about what's going on with all of that. We just, the curtains just peel back a little bit to get us to understand there is so much going on behind the scenes that we're just not aware of. You know, and so we have to remember that our Christian lives, we're on a battlefield that we don't even see. You know, but we read about, and we understand from Scripture, but it is very real. It is happening all around us in the heavenly places, not just on planet Earth. And there are wars being waged that we are foot soldiers in, that we've got to open our minds to. That our lives matter because we're in this kind of cosmic conflict. And so that gives a lot of meaning to the passages before this in Ephesians, where it says, husbands, here's how you treat your wives. Wives, here's how you have a relationship with your husbands. Parents, here's how you raise your children. Children, here's how you relate to your parents. And here's what you do with slaves and masters. All these things, all these instructions before this passage in Ephesians 6 are brought to new light when you consider, here's why that's important. Because we're in this spiritual conflict. And it also helps us appreciate where our focus should be. You know, as our nation gears up for yet another election season, where our news media, even long before, you know, the actual votes are going to be cast, our news media is just hyping up all these different candidates and all these news stories about them all, pitting them against each other, wanting us to really care deeply about that. This is an excellent reminder of where our focus ought to be, primarily. Am I saying we can't vote, we shouldn't vote? No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying this is where our primary focus ought to be on is these dark spiritual forces. That is the true enemy. It's not the Democrats, it's not the Republicans, it's not who we think should be a part of this office or that office. It is this conflict that we should be engaged in. And think about Jesus when he walked among us. Yes, he argued with Pharisees and Sadducees and the religious leaders. And he had plenty of conversations where he tried to turn their hearts and minds, but he never lost sight of who he was fighting. And that's why he said in Matthew 16, you remember when Peter took him aside and said, You're saying you're going to go die? You are not going to go die. We are not going to let that happen to you. Remember what he said? Get behind me, Peter. No, get behind me, Satan. Because he understood who was using Peter's mouth at that particular point in time. Do you remember also in the Gospel of Luke, in Luke chapter 22, verse 53, when he is getting arrested, he's getting taken in, he says to them, "When I was with you day after day in the temple, you didn't lay a hand on me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness." It's a really ominous phrase. It's the power of darkness's hour. Because he understood, this is not about just Judas. It's not about these religious leaders. It's not even about the Romans. It's really about the forces behind all of them that are using them as pawns on this chessboard that they're all playing on. But he understands who's moving those pawns. This is who we are fighting, and this ought to transform our daily lives in profound ways. Remember when Peter is writing his letter, he doesn't say, "You know, I really want to tell you about the latest on Nero. I want to talk about how terrible he is, about the parties that he is hosting in Rome, and all the debaucheries of his court and his lifestyle. You know, let's get revved up and let's form an anti-Nero league as Christians." Nero doesn't make an appearance in there at all. There is instruction about honoring the king, honoring the emperor in your relationship with him, but nothing else said about who he was and what he was doing. So this helps us keep our lives in perspective. Rather, Peter said, let me tell you about the ravenous beast who wants to devour you. And so rather than keeping alert with all perseverance in Facebook posts and news articles, we need to be keeping alert in prayer. As he says in chapter 6, if you're still in Ephesians, chapter 6, if you just look down the page, that's what he says. Praying at all times in the Spirit, verse 18, with all prayer and supplication. To that end, keep alert with all perseverance, making supplications for all the saints and for Paul himself. He says he needed help. That's our focus. That is who we are fighting against. And so, when we apply that to ourselves, we also should think about each other and how we're not the enemy. And I want to go to chapter 4 with you. Stay in Ephesians. Go to chapter 4. We're going to read 25 through 27. He says, therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. And notice this last phrase especially, give no opportunity to the devil. When you back up, verse 25, Paul is especially concerned with how Christians operate in a local congregation, because verse 25 says, we are members of one another. I don't think he's talking about Christians and outsiders. He's talking about Christians and Christians. How do we treat each other? There are things that we can't do. Verse 25, don't lie. Speak the truth. Be honest about your spiritual life. Verse 26, don't hold on to anger. No, it's not inherently sinful to be angry, but if you hold on to that and you let that live on a shelf space in your heart, what does that do in verse 27? It gives the person that we are primarily fighting an opportunity to get his foot in the door of your heart or my heart so that he can drive a wedge between other people who should be united with each other in Jesus. Why is that so important? Why is it so important to follow these instructions? It's not primarily because, this is how you have great relationships, or not primarily because, you know, this is how you form a comfortable congregation. Lack of conflict is certainly nice, but the primary point here is you've got an enemy who wants to see you die, who wants to see all of us die. And one of the oldest tactics in the book, if you're fighting an enemy, is to divide the person, the group that you are fighting against. Divide and conquer, isn't that a phrase that we sometimes use? Tactic in military operations. Satan wants to do that, wants us to forget that we're fighting him. And then, of course, this warning is similar to Genesis 4. Do you remember when Cain was angry, and he was very much upset about the way that God treated his brother's sacrifice versus his sacrifice? Do you remember God coming to him and saying in chapter 4, verse 7 of Genesis, you know what sin's doing, Cain? It's crouching at the door like a vicious beast, waiting for you to open your door a crack so that he can come in and get you and eat you alive. So get rid of your anger. You have no right to hold on to that. Sin is always crouching at our doors, our congregation's door, and the doors of our hearts. So we need to remember who we're fighting and the project that we are a part of. Chapter 3, verse 10. I want to end with this. Go to chapter 3 and verse 10 of Ephesians. I just give context. Let's start in verse 8. To me, though I am the very least of all the saints, this grace was given to preach to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ, and to bring to light for everyone what is the plan of the mystery hidden for ages in God who created all things. Who is the everyone in that verse? Is it just people? Jews and Gentiles? Look at the next verse, verse 10. So that through the church, the manifold wisdom of God might be now made known to who? To the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. He's not saying just so that the emperor in Rome and all the governors that get spoken to in the book of Acts and other places that they can understand the gospel, although it's certainly including them. He's talking specifically in this verse about the devil and the devil's angels and all the other angels who worship and serve God so that they all can see the wisdom that he has. Wisdom that he showed in creating us as little dust creatures who are made in his image, though, made to and designed to rule over planet Earth with justice and love and multiplication in the same way that God rules over the universe. And we failed that purpose, obviously, if you look at the Bible story. But God shows his wisdom in sending his Son to redeem us and to rescue us, so that those of us who can't even see him, can't even see any of this that's going on that this verse is talking about, will believe in it. And we'll pattern our lives after it, so that someday, in our resurrected bodies, this will become sight. We will be a visible part of this in a way that we can understand. But so that now we show God's wisdom, that we will follow him to the death, whether he blesses us with 10 children or not, whether he blesses us with all the camels and the sheep and the oxen or not, whether that is in our pasture or it's not, whether we have abundant physical things like Job did or whether we don't, as Job's life turned into before he got it all back again, regardless of what our situation is like, whether we have an easy life or a hard life, and all of us will have hard lives in some ways, we're going to follow him, no matter what. And when the angels, whether they follow God or not, when they see that happening in our lives, that brings God glory. That's what our lives are for. To bring God glory in this kind of way. So as Christians, we need to think about whether we have this perspective in our minds, whether we're remembering this like we should. So does your life matter? You better believe your life matters. Do you have a far-reaching influence? You better believe you have a far-reaching influence. Are there people looking at you? Sure, all around you. But are there creatures that you're not even aware of looking at you? Absolutely. Think about that when you're tempted to not do what you should do as a Christian. Whether you're faced with that choice of should I serve and sacrifice in love or should I selfishly grab what I think should be mine? Are we upright and blameless? Are we taking on the characteristics of the one who wants to eat our lunch? Because that's who the devil is. We're fighting him whether we know it or not. And our lives are exhibit A to the spiritual forces in the heavenly places. If that doesn't give us meaning and value, knowing that we are God's instruments in this kind of warfare, I don't know what will. So let's take encouragement from that. That there are so many who know who you are. But most especially, God knows who you are. And if you want to come to him today and you want to surrender your life to him and you want to show those spiritual forces who you really serve, we'd be happy to help you with that, to start studying with you. If you are ready to become a Christian, we can help you with that too. If we can pray for you, please let us know how we as a congregation can serve your needs as best we can. And we're going to sing an invitation song, and let's stand up to sing that together.